This is 89.9 WWNO. Yes, we're headed for another art-filled week. Are you making plans or do you need some ideas? Well, you've come to the right place. Whether you're in the mood for conversation with a Broadway star, a dark comedy, or a scholarly trek through history, it's all in the mixed media. Come along as we go inside the arts. Hi, I'm your host, Diane Mack. Broadway star Faith Prince is coming to town. The Guys and Dolls Tony Award-winning actress is performing with SiriusXM radio star Seth Rudesky in the Broadway at Noka series. We caught up with Faith in Los Angeles by phone. Hello.
Hey.
You have been stunning audiences for years in numerous roles, including Miss Adelaide in Guys and Dolls. And you've come a long way from your southern roots growing up in Augusta, Georgia. How did it all happen for you?
Well, that's a long road, honey. But I was in Augusta till I was about six, then I moved to Virginia. And I was there till I was 17, and then went to the Cincinnati Conservatory of Music, which, you know, at that time they didn't have many schools that gave a Bachelor of Fine Arts in Musical Theater. But I went there, and that was life-changing for me. And then soon after, I went and got my equity card in Washington, D.C., and that took about 3 months, and then I moved to New York City, and that's where it all began, in 1981.
And when did you know that you were called to entertain?
Well, my dad was really funny, and I remember watching him as a kid and telling jokes and telling stories, and he would always just sort of entertain people when they came over, and I would look at him and I'd go, I think I could do that. And then I was pretty funny in school. You know, was always in the church choir and the chorus in school. And then I had a chorus teacher about my maybe ninth grade year. He said, you know, I think you got something here. And I was like, really?
Guys and Dolls, was that your big break?
I guess. It had been building up to that. It was probably the culmination is what I would say.
Can you tell us about your audition for that role, Miss Adelaide?
Well, I talk about it in Seth's show, so I don't really want to divulge that. But it was a very interesting sort of, when most people go in and sing the lament from Guys and Dolls, I had to choose another song. So I had to pick something else that would show my Adelaide. So let's just say it was an interesting song to choose, and you would have never thought that character would have chosen it. And you'll have to come see the show to hear what it is. That show has just been a piece of my career. I mean, that was 25 years ago.
Yeah.
You know, that I did Guys and Dolls. I've done many, many things since then and many different roles. I'm a character actress. I've done a lot of TV, film, other characters. I've done Aggie and Kate of the Fair. I've done Ella Peterson in Bells Are Ringing. I've done Belle Watson in Little Me. And just worked with great people and just had a fun career, and it just keeps going, and it's been a lot of fun.
And what are you doing when you're not on stage?
I teach, I coach, I direct a little. I have a lot of Skype students one-on-one all over the globe. People find me, and I help them either figure out what they want to do in the business. I'm sort of a life coach, or we work on material, or they put an act together, or they're auditioning for something and I coach them through it. It's just a myriad of things. And everybody is all ages and all different things. And I really love it. I think it's probably the thing I was meant to do. I love performing and I will always do that. But I think I do the performing so I can teach.
Do you have an embarrassing teaching moment?
No, not embarrassed. I will say this girl did a song from Closer Than Ever. Me, and this was in a master class. This was at the St. Louis Cabaret Conference, and I'm sitting there going, gee, that song is really familiar. And then I realized at the end of it, I had done the first incarnation of it in a little show called Urban Blight that was at Manhattan Theater Club. And it was about this woman that had gone through years of with his husband, and I think I performed it when I was probably like maybe 32. And this woman sang it. I went, oh, my God. I said, I did that song. And I said, now I know what it's about.
Talk about coming full circle.
Well, I'm 60, yeah. And I thought, gee, that sounds familiar. And I thought, I had no business singing that song at 32. It's so funny.
The upcoming performance at NOCA is a wild card with Seth Rudesky at the helm. How are you preparing for the interview and performance?
Oh, honey, there's no preparing for Seth Rudesky. You just got to go with it. And honestly, it's always different. It is never the same. I mean, we just did two shows in Provincetown, and each night it was completely different.
What do you think you will sing?
I don't know, really. I mean, it could be everything from maybe a little of The Lament, but it might be something from Falsetto Land. It could be something from Bells Are Ringing. It could be something from Sondheim's Company. He just kind of goes through my book and tells a story, and then he picks something. I mean, it's kind of wild.
Yeah. What are you most proud of in your career to date?
Probably my diversity. I mean, the fact that the same woman could be Adelaide on Broadway and be Mrs. Anna and then be Aggie and Kate or the Bear, I think shows a well-rounded bulk of work.
Is there something special in addition to your stage performance that you hope to do while in New Orleans?
I love New Orleans. I was down there filming Scream Queens the last time. I was Billy Lord's mother. He was my child that I had had with Charlie Manson. Go figure. That town for me, you know, I have a real thing about past lives. And when I'm in certain cities, I can really feel the ghosts. And boy, I can feel the ghosts down there. And it's palpable. So I love the food. I love the town. It's rich with complexity. And I love that.
Broadway star Faith Prince, thanks so much and enjoy New Orleans.
Thank you. I'm looking forward to it. Come out and see me.
I will. Bye-bye now. Faith Prince performs Friday at NOCA, 2800 Charter Street, 8 p.m. More info online at BroadwayNOLA.com. You're listening to Inside the Arts on 89.9 WWNO, New Orleans Public Radio. I'm Diane Mack. Question: can a pop culture cartoon influence a new civilization? That's an idea being explored in the regional premiere of Anne Washburn's Mr. Burns, a post-electric play, presented by the Radical Buffoons and Rockfire Theater. If the name Mr. Burns rings a bell, excellent! He is the villain owner of a nuclear power plant in the animated TV sitcom The Simpsons. Big Easy Award-winning director Jonathan Green of the Radical Buffoons joins us with cast members Rebecca Elizabeth Hollingsworth and Raheem Glasby. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Diane.
Thank you so much for having us, Diane.
Yes, thank you.
Jonathan, congrats on your new company, The Radical Buffoons. Tell us about this group of performers.
So the Radical Buffoons is a production collective. It's not necessarily associated with the performers themselves on this project. I started this company as a way to keep doing the kind of envelope-pushing work that I've had the opportunity and pleasure to do in New Orleans for the past couple years, work that is physically evocative and socially provocative and always using humor as a vehicle for storytelling. And I was approached by Rockfire Theater Company to direct this show. And so the Radical Buffoons was formed to be a co-production company with Rockfire.
And what attracted you to this particular production?
The obvious answer is The Simpsons. I've also been really compelled by wasteland tales and post-apocalyptic tales. And so the confluence of those two things kind of hit all of my pop culture nerves. And then diving into this play with music and dance and really epic storytelling, it just sunk its teeth in, and I couldn't get it out of my brain from the first time I heard about it and read it.
What's the premise?
So Anne Washburn was commissioned by a theater company in New York called The Civilians, and they were interested in examining how pop culture might traverse an endpoint and how we've kind of turned towards popular culture as our communal myth and folklore. The first act is about a year after a kind of nuclear meltdown apocalypse that has ended all electricity in America and most likely the world. And a group of survivors are sitting around a campfire trying to navigate their trauma by communally remembering a Simpsons episode, something they can all kind of remember that brought them joy and gives them a little bit of distraction in these hard times. And then in the second act, that group of people, 7 years later, has doubled down and become a mule and cart performance troupe that travels around the country presenting those memories to audiences in this post-electric era. And then in the third act, which is 75 years after that, once civilization has been restructured, that original episode has become a fully realized mask pop operetta.
Oh, my.
Oh, my. Absolutely.
So, Rebecca and Raheem, tell us about your characters and what drew you to the role.
You want to go first?
That's actually a line in the show where yeah. I ask her, do you want to go first?
You go first.
Okay, I'll go first. In the first act, I am playing Jenny. She is one of the survivors. In the second act, I'm also playing Jenny, as well as the second act, Marge. And the third act, I am playing Itchy, as in Itchy and Scratchy, who has become a toxic sort of mouse demon, I would call him. I was really attracted to these roles because the diversity in the characters you get to play, being able to investigate what drives a person at different points in a catastrophe is something really appealing.
Yes. I play Matt. I play Homer at a point. And then in Act 3, I play Bart. I think what really drew me to this was the fact that I got to play Bart. I'm just going to be honest. And man, the music is breathtaking. It is so good. And the messages behind everything really got me going.
And the music was written for the play by Michael Friedman, who unfortunately just passed away last week, I believe. He's also the composer and lyricist behind Bloody Bloody Andrew Jackson. People don't know his work as much in this show, but the music is astounding. And the third act operetta, he has taken cues from so many 90s and early 2000 pieces of pop culture. If you really listen, you'll hear like changed references to Jurassic Park, to The Simpsons, to Scooby-Doo, to Live in La Vida Loca. Like, he's just funneled all these oral memories into his music, and it's astounding in that way.
In essence, how do memories of The Simpsons bring people together in this production in what appears to be end times?
Something that's explored through this play is the need for nostalgia and the commodity that nostalgia can become. And through these survivors telling these stories, they create an entire business, an entire infrastructure by the second act of nostalgia. So they turn comfort into monetary value in a lot of ways, which I find interesting.
Mm-hmm. I think that The Simpsons have managed to cross a lot of demographics because it's a cartoon, because they're yellow, because there's a representation of every archetype in America. And so whether you watch The Simpsons or not, or if you do watch The Simpsons, it's always been a really broad comedic picture of our entire country community. And so I think that's how The Simpsons lend itself to this moment in this post-apocalyptic times, post-electric times, that there's that universality that they didn't expect to be the thing that could pull them all together. But sometimes the things you don't expect are the things that suck you in.
What are the themes that are being explored?
Certainly nostalgia and the unshakable human spirit.
Stories and how we define stories and they define us. Survival.
Holding on to humanity in the best way possible during a disaster.
What it means to be a tribe.
Mm.
What do we learn from our need to tell stories?
If we didn't have stories as part of our human experience, if that were just removed completely from existence, I think a piece of our natural humanity would be gone. The story is the thing that joins the community, and it's the glue that holds the community together, and it's the thing that drives the community forward. And if stories were just not a part of our human experience, I don't really know rightly what would become of civilization. I think it would fall completely apart beyond its socioeconomic structure. And I don't know that without stories it would be able to be picked back up.
Is there hope in the end?
Bart has a line at the end of the third act that happens amidst a cacophony of beautiful sound as the finale of the third act approaches that cuts off, and Bart says,
"Love never dies in memory."
And I think that's the hope. That's the final message. To go from the immediate trauma to understanding that love continues on regardless of experience. So in answer to your question, yes, I do think that there is hope.
Short answer, yes.
Director Jonathan Green and actors Rebecca Elizabeth Hollingsworth and Raheem Glaspie, thanks for stopping by.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you so much.
Mr. Burns, a post-electric play, opens Friday with performances running through October 7th at Art Club, KLUB, 1941 Arch Street. More info at artclub.eventbrite.com. Uptown, scholars are paying tribute to a saint as the 8th annual conference known as the Salon de Jeanne d'Arc, presented by the makers of the Joan of Arc Parade, gets underway at Tulane University. It's an educational event with an accent on fun. Coordinator Amy Kirk is here. Welcome back.
Bonjour.
How are you?
And congratulations to you as your passion for keeping Joan of Arc's story alive garnered the Chevalier Award. Tell us about this honor and what it means to you.
Well, thank you for mentioning that. I get more reminded about that by others, and it's very humbling. I think about the journey of the Joan of Arc Parade and how far it's come, and this award definitely is the icing on the cake. It is because of the former Consul General of France, Grégoire Tourmel, who has the ability to nominate people for this Order of Arts and Letters. And so I was completely surprised to get this letter in French at my home, and it just turned into this very dreamlike experience, frankly, where I was able to invite all the people who've helped me along the way. That was what I liked the most about it. It really spoke mostly to Joan of Arc, and it's all because of her. So I thank her ultimately.
And well deserved. Bring us up to speed on Joan's story and her connection to New Orleans.
We make the connection even stronger than it may be otherwise. Quite simply put, we have a statue of Joan in the French Quarter. Why do we have that? Because de Gaulle gave that as a gift to the city, and we have it because we are a French city. You know, we were founded by the French. As we approach our tricentennial, it makes everything come together really nicely for our 10th annual parade, too. And the parade was really started by me to just recognize her presence in the French Quarter and our French heritage, and really just to celebrate her life in a theatrical way.
And her story?
Well, Joan of Arc was born in 1412 in France, of course, and she claimed to hear voices when she was around 13, calling her to go to the governor to ask for basically an army to get her to the king, to help him. He wasn't yet the king, to help him become the king of France. So this was during the 100 Years' War, and she's credited with really leading troops to lift the siege of Orléans. We know that she's now Saint Joan, and it was really because she essentially saved France.
Are you still learning and uncovering new facts about Joan?
Constantly. I read somewhere that it's Abraham Lincoln and Jesus Christ and Joan of Arc who get the most books written about them. I don't know if that's changed.
So what's being explored at this year's Salon?
We have one local and two out-of-town visiting scholars who are coming in just to present for our Salon. The day kicks off with a talk by the local scholar, Dale Sugar, who's a PhD at Tulane and happens to be the head of Tulane's program in medieval and early modern studies. The first of our scholar talks is called Orleans, the Witch and Her Wardrobe, which is about
Joan's accusations of dressing like a man and what this definition of a witch would be in medieval time. Dr. Sugar happens to have done a lot of research on medieval witchcraft and accusations of that, so she's tying Joan into that. Our keynote speech is Saint and Starlet, Joan of Arc Invades Popular Culture. This is Dr. Stephanie Coker. She's now the assistant professor at the University of Alabama, and she teaches French language, literature, and culture. This was a woman that we found online who had been local. She got her doctorate in French from LSU. We're bringing her into town to talk about the TV show people may remember from 2002, 2003 called Joan of Arcadia. It's about a teenage girl in high school who hears voices, and it, of course, it's a comedy, but it has some other nuggets in there of meaning. Dr. Smithson, Tara Smithson, has been an avid follower of the parade, has interviewed me and other members of the crew for some papers that she had done at LSU about Joan of Arc. And she's going to be talking about Joan's virginity, really talking about why this was such a big deal, similar to Dr. Sugar's talk about the witchcraft accusation. Is just, again, looking at medieval times and why they continue to have to test Joan of Arc. And we close out the day with one of our great partners, Ecole Belang. They are going to be doing a student presentation that is going to go through Joan of Arc's story in various musical pieces and monologue.
I also heard there was a group that's going to be doing a presentation on costumes.
Our extraordinary costume designer, Antoinette de Alteris, has a historical costume background and works every year at the Renaissance Festival on weekends in between her day job. She, along with Clay LeBrun, are going to be talking specifically about medieval warrior costumes, which, of course, would be armor, weapons, and all related. Clay LeBrun is astonishing. Those of you who are at Culture Collision saw him walking around in full armor, and he's that guy. He's that guy who makes his own armor and then walks around in it. And he's made some armor for several of our crew members. And that is from 1:20 to 2:30 is this What a Medieval Warrior Wears talk.
What are you hoping folks will remember most from this experience that will make Joan's story relevant in modern times?
Everyone loves to just shorten her story to this poor crazy girl who heard voices and then ended up on a horse, when really she was middle class. Her dad was a tax collector. Her uncle knew the governor. So I think the more and more and more we learn that kind of stuff, you also find her more believable and understand that, you know, she didn't just appear out of nowhere, you know.
Amy Kirk, Salon de Jeanne d'Arc coordinator and crew de Jeanne d'Arc captain. Thanks.
Thank you.
The Salon de Jeanne d'Arc kicks off Saturday at the Woldenberg Art Center at Tulane University. It runs from 9:30 a.m. to 5 p.m. That's our show for this week. Support for Inside the Arts comes from the Hellas Foundation. Our program is a production of WWNO and is archived at WWNO.org. I'll be back with more ideas for your artistic palette Tuesdays at 1 p.m., Wednesdays at 8:30 p.m., and a shortened feature on Thursday mornings at 8:45 when we'll go Inside the Arts. I'm Diane Mack.